Colonel Neal in 7.
You heard at night talk about a gone down from there. He was an absolute terrible. His face is like a skull, his skin is just like pale yellow parchment. I thought he was going to die. We decided the only thing to do was to take his rifle and his pack and his equipment and strip those amongst the rest of the men. We couldn't leave him, we wouldn't leave him. What he needed was medical attention, and food. And none of those things we could give him. Fortunately, then perhaps a week, his fever started to get somewhat better. And he was strong enough to take back his rifle. We continued, however, to carry his pack and equipment. We cut him a stick to use as a walking stick. He staggered along as best he could, but he was capable of walking, and that was the main thing. The thought of having to carry a man on a stretcher in our state of health appalled me. Very worried greatly, because we simply could not have done it. We hadn't the strength to carry ourselves along there, and to carry a man on a stretcher would have been quite beyond us. But it's about this time, when Hartabala went down with malaria, that I found the sole of my left hotty boot had a large hole. I was now marching in a sock. And the right sole had part of my right foot that was tied on a parachute cord. Let me read again from my story. At every rest halt during our march towards Miney, Tag and I would discuss our contact with the Jack Elephant Patrol. We both believed that the reason the elephant had been towing the truck must be because the enemy in this particular area had probably run short of petrol. Neither of us, however, could explain why the Jap officer in the howdah had been dressed in white and had been wearing a white helmet. Later in the war, I came to know that a white pith helmet was a common form of headgear for Japanese military officers. They also frequently wore white shirts in some forms of dress. What we had thought was a white tunic being worn by the man on the elephant must have been only a white shirt. In our ignorance, his overall white turnout had caused us momentary confusion and indecision with unhappy results. Then, early one morning, we suddenly heard the noises of a village, cock crowing and people talking. We advanced cautiously to see whether the village was indeed mining. It was. In some trepidation, we entered the village, ready for trouble, thankful to find that we were greeted with smiles again. Tag and I, together with our Burma rifleman, Mong San, went to the headman's house. We clambered up the sloping log, horizontally cut steps to his house on the stilts, and while we did this, Budiman posted sentries around the village. The headman said that there had been no recent enemy movement in the area, and he thought we were probably likely to get safety to the children. The headman's wife kindly brought us some rice beer, which we drank with pleasure. Then we said our goodbyes and wished them good fortune. From Miney, we marched cross country towards the tiny village of Sapa on the Chinwin, which was 5 miles north of Tonhei, where we'd crossed originally. My right hotty boot sole and I had a large hole in it. I'd soon be barefoot. At about 1300 hours, we found an unused game trail, which we thought safe to use. On this trail, we met a villager. He smiled at us, and we smiled at him. I called Mong San up to ask him where we were. The villager said he was from Sapa, which is not far, and he would gladly take us there. So we let him guide us, and we soon reached Sapa, which is a tiny little village, 3 to 4 huts, no more. And having got there, we asked him if we could hire boats. His answer was the last answer we hoped to hear. He said that all the boats in the east bank of the Chinwin had been collected by the Japs and sent up under escort to their headquarters at Homeland, a big village some 20 miles to the north. There was nothing on our side of the village. But our spirits, which had risen on getting near to the chimney, immediately fell. The morale was rock bottom. We went forward to the river, and I saw once again the children of our dreams and prayers. The children at that point were probably some 250 yards wide, according to my map, and was very fast playing. Pang and I could probably swim across without weapons or equipment and helping one another. This is an academic point, play, as our men couldn't swim, neither of us would or could be. What could we do? We decided the only thing to do was build rafts, such as we done to cross the Strait River so long ago. Well, before we started building rafts, I thought, well, let's try to think of something else. And I went forward, and my mind going round and round in circles. And I stood on an open clearing, looking out across the river. And as I was standing there and worrying terribly about what we might do to escape, I heard a call from the far side in Nepali. Ko'o, who is it? And I immediately replied with the third second Gurkhas, have you got a boat that side? We found there's none on this side. He said, I've got one. Wait, I'll bring it or send it. So I told him to hurry up as quickly as he could. The men, of course, had heard my conversation with what I assumed would be a V-force levy. I knew they recruited Gurkhas. And they were absolutely delighted. So I told Tag what we'd been saying to one another, and he also was equally delighted. The friendly villager who'd guided us to Sapa was still standing there. So I went up to him, thanked him, and paid him for his help. And I noticed he'd got the most marvellous dao hanging from a sash from his shoulder. He had silver work on the hilt and silver work on the scabbard, and I was on the point of asking him to let me buy it. When suddenly the man cried out, the boat was coming. Sure enough, I looked down on the far side of the river. There was a boatman paddling up a dugout canoe, quite a small one, up along the far bank, and when he got opposite us, he turned across the river and brought his boat to on our side of the river. And we reckoned it would take no more than four men, so I put in Havadar Budiman, a Sikh Harkabada, and two riflemen, and sent them on over the river. We continued, now standing too on the banks of the river, watching towards the jungle. After a while of some concern, the boat seemed to take a long time to return. Eventually, men called out saying it was coming again. So we sent four more men across, and the boat turned around, took them off, and eventually, after a long wait, it came back. There were now five of us, including Tag and me. So we decided to put Mong Sam and two of my riflemen in the boat and send that off, and Tag and I would wait till the end. When the boat had gone, we were absolutely on our own, with the wide river behind us, so we reckoned we ought to take maximum precautions. We got down below the bank, on either side of the track that led down to the river, and we waited there and waited and waited. I put my safety catch automatic, and we looked towards the jungle, and wondered and wondered whether the Japs would come and jump us at this 11th hour, or whether we'd get away with it. I looked round at one stage, these thoughts swirling around my mind, and there, sure enough, the boat came back to the first again. When it got to our side of the bank, us over the river, all right. We both clambered in. Tad got in first, and I got in after him. We put our packs down in the middle of the boat. We sat down, and the boat then turned his boat round, went over to the far side, and then down the far bank. And sitting there, I pulled out my last cheroot, which I described to you earlier, and I tried to light it. The first match from my damp matchbox didn't light, but the second one did. And I lit my cigar and sat there as happy as a sandboy, smoking away. And I looked round, and I could see Sapa, tiny village, disappearing from our sight. The next thing I knew was we'd come upon the V-Force post, which we discovered was at a village called Kwemate. And there was Wayne Budiman and my other men waiting to greet us. And there was a young captain commanding the V-Force post. We must have exchanged names, but to this day I cannot remember what he was called. Anyway, the first thing I asked him was, what date was it? He told me 6th of June. We'd long since lost any idea of what day or date it was. And that is certainly one date that will always remain in my mind. On that night, after the men had been fed, we were given the most marvellous surprise in the shape of a meal of Tag and I, that is, in the shape of a meal of M&V stew, meat and vegetable stew. We had always liked this when we used to get it in the rations. And to get it again was a real treat. And after our M&V stew, we had some shakapura biscuits and a pound tin of blackcurrant jam. It was the most marvellous meal I could ever recall. And we were warned by our V-Force hosts that if we ate too much, we could well have tummy troubles. He'd heard that many of our escape parties on reaching our own side of the river, the Two River villages, had eaten greatly for obvious reasons, and they'd gone down with awful tummy problems. However, we were lucky we never had such disasters happening to us. We were able to eat as much as we wanted. But it was really quite incredible to find that we were being filled again by real substantial food. We've been so long without it. Let me read again from my story. When we had finished our splendid meal, we were offered cigarettes. Whilst we smoked, our V-Force host said he would give us a mule the following morning to carry our packs together with the muleteer, who would guide us to the third tent base at Tanaum, the third tent Gurkhas, I mean, some 7 miles away to the west. He had already informed the third tent adjutant of our pending arrival. We thanked him for our excellent and memorable meal, and I excused myself to go and see that my men were all right for the night. We were already fast asleep, so I returned to the mess where Tag and I took our blankets from our packs, lay down in the bamboo bed allotted to us, and prepared to go to sleep. It was a very odd feeling indeed to lie there, knowing that we were safe, at long last. We had been thoroughly defeated, but we had still had our pride. I was proud that all of us in our tiny group had come back with all our equipment, weapons and ammunition, particularly so as our host had been and told us tales during supper, that many of our escape parties had returned across the chimney without their weapons, being thrown away in order to lighten their loads. I have always believed that a soldier's weapon should remain in his possession until he is killed or told to surrender by one of his superiors. One might think that my mind and its thoughts would have been swirling round and round in my head that night. This is not how it was for me. I clearly remember that I felt utterly tranquil. I knew we had been routed and we had to retreat over hundreds of miles through a hostile wilderness, but we had achieved our aim. We had escaped, and we had outwitted our officers of the Japanese 33 Division. We could now fight them on another day and another place. Overshadowing all such thoughts to my sorrow at losing 89, we were so close to freedom, and of course losing an unknown number of men as our tower in the ambush. These thoughts flashed through my mind in seconds, and then I fell asleep. The deepest, most peaceful sleep that I can ever remember. The heavy weight of responsibility I'd been carrying had suddenly been lifted. At long last, my waking life had ended. We awoke the following morning for the first time in months and understood the meaning of being a free man. Every man must have felt the same, I'm sure of that. After a morning meal, the reinforced military guide reported the mule. We loaded our packs with mules and said goodbye and asked the reinforced captain to accept our gratitude. The Buddhiman reported all present and correct, and I called out for the last time, Dujanagare. Bandilal and Dandara went forward with huge grins on their faces. Off we went, headed for the third tent at Tanan. We had a relatively easy march for the whole of that day. We had a 1,000-foot ridge to cross, but with the mule to help us carry our packs, it was no problem at all, even in our weakened condition. I remember when we got to Nan, either the 13th adjutant or maybe it was the IO met us, and he called the town Havildar Major to take the men to a barrack, an attap hut, and to have them fed in the cookhouse. We were taken to the mess, Tag and I. We were given clean clothes to wear that evening in mess. There were showers, we had a shower. We were introduced after our shower to the officers in the mess, including the CEO, but I had no idea who they were or what they were called. My mind was just whirling. After our meal, which I can't even remember what that was, we were given whiskies and sodas, and goodness knows how many we drank, but we must have drank a few of us that night. We slept like the dead. If we continue with my story. The next morning we got up and changed back into our foul, tattered clothes. Tag and I had our breakfast in the mess, and the men had their morning meal from the cookhouse. We were to be taken then by truck some 5 miles further west to the field supply depot at Moray. As our party was waiting for the transport to appear, the 13th adjutant, or maybe it's their intelligence officer again, came up to Tag and me to report that the signal had just arrived in the reinforced post of Waymate. He said that he was sure its contents would be of interest to us. He went on to tell us that the previous day, the day after we'd escaped across the Chinmen, a reinforced reconnaissance patrol had set off across the Chinmen to the village of Sapa. Subsequently, it had returned to base to report the amazing story of our party's escape that on the afternoon of 6 June. Apparently, the Jap fighting patrol of platoon strength had been tracking us for about a week, very possibly ever since we'd had the contact with the elephant patrol on the Metcalfe track. This fighting patrol must have been really close on their heels, as they arrived at our crossing point at Sapa only half an hour after we had crossed the river. I could hardly believe my ears when this report was delivered to us. In war, men's fate hangs so often on a very thin and fragile thread. In our case, the thread could not have been thinner. Had we had to delay at Sapa in order to construct rafts, we would have been caught. Had I not been standing on the children's edge of that particular clearing, and had the Gurkha levy of V-Force not been passing at that very moment, or had he failed to see me, I would not have been accosted and asked for my identity. Had this encounter not taken place when it did, we would never have been sent the single boat which proof of our salvation. Under the circumstances, I have little doubt that the method and timing of our escape was nothing short of a miracle. Time and time again, since that June afternoon, I recalled my memory of those events leading up to our arrival on the east bank of that final river barrier, and of course our crossing itself. A chill has always passed through me whenever my imagination takes over such thoughts. Had that Jap platoon caught up with us with our backs to the river, how long could we have fought them off in our weakened condition, and with many rifle boats rusted to their reaches? I like to believe we would have sold our lives dearly, and we would have taken many, many Japs with us to Kingdom Come. But had they come upon us when Tag and I were alone together, awaiting the final boat trip? And yet, that is how it could have been for us. I have no doubt that the Almighty and Lady Luck combined on that afternoon to make our escape possible. Certainly, neither Tag nor I contributed anything to either the timing or method of our party's escape. We'd done our job by that time. We'd led our men through the wilderness and through the searching patrols of Japanese 33 Division. But we needed help to get across the children to safety, and thank God we got it in the nick of time. So we said goodbye to the 3rd Tenth and thanked them for all their kindness, and we went on by transport this time, by road to FSD Field Supply Depot at Moray, which is really quite close. We got there on the 8th of June. The FSD was the British captain and took my men to a basha and had them fed, and took Tag and me to another basha which had been serving as a store. I saw the men feeding and returned to smoke some V cigarettes which the 3rd Tenth had given us in our basha. Then our meal arrived. Whilst we were eating, we heard the rain start to fall. We looked out of a window in the darkening sky and saw the rain coming down like steroids. This is no ordinary shower, this was the monsoon proper, against which we had been racing. We'd beaten it by 2 days. Here for us all was another miracle. The rains that had laid out returned to Imphal on 13 June. But whilst the FSD, two things stick out to my memory. I'd got my maps out, and I reckoned that the distance we had possibly or probably marched from Dimapur, Redhead, to the Swale River and back to Nam must have been, give or take, 100 miles, 1,000 miles covered. But who can say this is really conjecture on my part, but looking at our maps and reckoning how we twisted and turned, I'm pretty sure my estimate was probably right. The second thing I remember doing in the FSD at Moray was finding and stealing a 4-pound tin of plum jam. We found it was up on a shelf behind some books. We got it down, and I opened it up with a big Burry knife I was carrying, and we ate that 4-pound tin of jam without any biscuits in about 5 minutes flat. It was absolutely wonderful getting some sweet stuff inside us for which we've been longing for so long. On the evening of the 12th of June, after eating our stolen jam, the OCFSD came and said we'd leave in all probability for Imphal the following morning. The rains had caused landslides to damage the road, and there'd been no question we couldn't have got away before the 13th of June. But anyway, he thought that the working parties which had been out to repair the road had got things ready enough for us to leave on that date. So, the following morning, as arranged, we went off in trucks for Imphal, along the same route we'd taken all those months ago, beneath Scraggy and Gibraltar, through Shenan Pass, and then Palau, and on to Imphal Plain. We were taken to Four Corps headquarters, where the hospital was, as far as I can remember. And when we got off our trucks at Four Corps, we were waiting for guides to take us to the hospital to be checked over. I remember from out of an office-type tent, three staff officers appeared. They were smelling of roses, clean clothes, met with no talent. And one of them looked down his patrician nose at his two friends and looked at me. He said, "Oh, he must be from Longcloth. He might as well have been saying, oh, he must be the sweeper." I looked back at these chaps and they must have seen the fury in my eyes as they turned about and went on their way. Later in the Burma War, the combat infantrymen used to refer to staff officers and ADCs as the gabardine swine, as many of them had their uniforms made from the material of gabardine. And I'm sure that every one of them must have known about their epithet eventually, and I hope they hung their heads in shame. At least these men could have come up and given a welcome, I'd have thought, to our scarecrow party, who had obviously just escaped, but no. Well, we went off to hospital then. Sarah Luce, the other ex ward, and Tad and Reeve, the officer's ward. First of all, we were told we'd have to get our beards shaved off, which we were glad to have done for us. And the barber came and advised us to cut with scissors as best we could most of our beards before we got to work with a razor. And that was done, and our beards came off. Sadly, there was no one there with a camera who could have taken a photograph of us with our beards on. I'd rather like to have such a photograph of family records, but anyway, we were clean-shaven again once more. The next thing that happened to us after our beards came off was we were checked over in hospital, of course, and various tests were carried out. Suddenly, Wingate appeared, doing one of his regular visits to hospital, which was very right and proper. When he approached my bed, I stood up and stood to attention. He looked at me, his piercing eyes. He said, "Oh, I see you're out," and passed on to the next bed. I very nearly said to him, "Yes, but no thanks to you, sir." Fortunately, I held my peace and didn't get myself into trouble, but that was the last time I saw him. I'd have thought at least he could have asked when we got out, how we got out, no. Furthermore, we were expecting to be visited by intelligence from Four Corps, to be debriefed on what we'd seen, where we'd found Japanese movement, etc. Not a bit of it. No one came to see us. No one gave a damn. And we'd said to ourselves, Tag and I, on our way out, that we didn't expect we'd ever see any press reports of Wingate's expedition in the newspapers in India when we got back. Again, we were wrong. We found, looking through recent back copies of the Times of India and other such newspapers, that there were banner headlines, Wingate's expedition had done this, that and the other thing. We couldn't believe our eyes, which we had achieved nothing. We'd been kicked out by the Japs again. From Burma. And I suppose it was that, first of all, the previous year, 42, saw the disastrous retreat from southern Burma back into India. And then at the beginning of the year,